If you look at evolutionary history, we are comprised of genes, and as biological organisms, those genes are kind of the blueprints to some degree of who we are and how we work. And so if you look at kind of Charles Darwin, the theory of natural selection, and you look at a lot of the early work by Gregor Mendel, you probably see intro biology textbooks, you know, that they were playing around with peas and seeing how genes kind of reproduced in successive generations.
Ian Moreau, a researcher at the University of Manitoba, who is doing his PhD on environmental and socioeconomic risks and benefits of genetically modified crops, led a discussion at the University of Winnipeg on November 3, 2005, on genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and related issues. Moreau has been studying GMOs for the past 4 years and has had the opportunity to talk to many world experts about the subject. During this time, he and others have also been working on a documentary, which will be released November 30th in Winnipeg, that deals with this issue and the impact GMOs have on farmers. In the next 20 minutes, we will talk about the race to map the human genome and its implications. We will analyze the court system and raise the question at what point it steps in to prevent the research on GMOs. We will talk about the links between corporations and the pharmaceutical industry and talk about how we can promote good science, which benefits all of humanity. A report was released in mid-October 2005 in Science Magazine, a well-known and respected magazine among scientists, which did a critical analysis of all the gene patents that have been taken out of the human genome.
In 2000, scientists mapped the human genome. They basically found that not how the genes work in our body, but where they exist and the fact that they exist, and they basically have a blueprint of the human genome. And as soon as they started to map the genome, there was a huge race for it, and there was a whole bunch of public medical groups in the States, if that's not an oxymoron, but the government had research teams mapping the genome, and they thought it would take, I don't know, a lot longer than it did. And the lead guy for the U.S. Human Genome Patenting Project, his name was Craig Venture. He was one of the main guys involved in the U.S. program. Once he realized what was going on and realized he could make a pile of money by the outcomes of this with all these patents and whatnot, he jumped out, started his own startup company, and raced the government that he once worked for to map the genome. And so it happened way faster because the private sector started to race the public sector for mapping the human genome. And as you can just imagine, that's spelling disaster, right? There's a commercial race over the human genome. And they mapped the genome much faster than they thought they would be able to. And simultaneously to mapping it, even though scientists around the world didn't understand how it worked, people started to patent it. And so in 2 weeks ago in Science, they did a critical analysis of how many patents have been taken out on the human genome, and 18.5% of the human genome has been patented. And the vast majority of the patents taken out on the human genome have been taken out by US multinational companies. And so when you start to look at this, it's not just an agricultural issue, it's much more complicated than that, it's much more serious than that. You know, people might not give a crap about agriculture because they go to Safeway to buy their food, and you know that's as far as they think about the food system, but I think it hits a much kind of stronger chord when you start to talk about the fact that companies have patented the genes that code for breast cancer. There's two genes that code for breast cancer, and a Utah-based company used public health data to determine the nature of the genes, the characteristics of the genes, and they patented often the companies will not patent the genes specifically, because it's like I said, there's kind of these, you have to take it outside the body, be able to replicate it, and you can patent it. But the other way that they get control is by patenting the processes by which you understand and extract the genes. And so your particular analysis doesn't necessarily own the gene, but you own everything around it. You own all the technology for understanding the gene, and if you can control the knowledge of if you can patent the knowledge about the gene, then you effectively patent the gene. And so these companies basically got access to the gene, figured out how it worked, and then patented like a fortress around the gene, everything that you can around how to understand that gene. And so now they ended up sending letters to public labs throughout Canada and the US that were doing breast cancer screening for hereditary breast cancer. And I think it occurs in 5 to 10% of the population is hereditary breast cancer. And if you want a screening prior to the patent, if you wanted a screening, I believe it was about $800 to get a screening test for hereditary breast cancer. As soon as the company got the patent, they sent letters to all the companies that were doing the tests, and there was kind of a leeway period where they figured out how to do it. They got a whole bunch of companies doing it. Once there was enough people doing it and there was a market for it, they said, okay, now we're sending out our letters. Now if you want to do it, you have to pay. There's only one lab in Toronto that does the testing now. All of the labs across the country, you're not allowed to do the testing. And now the price goes from $800 Canadian to $3,000 Canadian. And they figured out how those genes worked, and they got access to those genes through public health records. And so people who were suffering from hereditary breast cancer offered all this information to this company in the hopes that, you know, their families and their daughters and their moms and their dads down the line wouldn't have to go through the same excruciating kind of lifestyle that they had to go through. And this company privatized, patented, and now is selling it back at over 3 times the price of what the screening tests were. And so that particular example is one of the really, really kind of gross and egregious examples of how patents over life forms, patents over genes are being used commercially at the expense of, you know, the people that the information comes from. So biopiracy is not just biological in terms of biodiversity, it's also human in origin.
The one question one has to ask is at what point the legal system catches up and steps in and speaks out at the implications of such research methods.
Based on my research, based on the amount of lawyers that I've had to spend, time I've spent with lawyers, either interacting with Percy Schmeiser, the farmer that got sued by Monsanto over infringing a patent to their canola, or so the Saskatchewan Organic Directorate, that's the group of organic farmers suing Monsanto and Bayer because of GMO contamination, and that's something we haven't even talked about, but these farmers are saying that they have been their livelihoods have been depressed because of the introduction of GMO canola, and they're fighting Monsanto and Bayer in the courts. You know, between our video at the university and having to fight to have our video released, I have a little bit of experience with the court system, and it seems to me that the courts largely are in the business of protecting capital. And so you look at the Schmeiser example, you know, the Schmeiser case. I was in the Supreme Court, and I actually went to the Supreme Court with Percy. I videotaped it. I made a documentary about it. And the Supreme Court was given the choice to decide in favor of, you know, this farmer who, if you really look at the evidence, was probably contaminated by GMOs. There's a lot of people that discredit that. I would say that if you talk to the scientists who really studied the case, the independent scientists that didn't work for Monsanto, he probably got contaminated. And I believe he got contaminated in his field. And we haven't gotten to that bizarre stage yet. People vilify the science. But that's, as a scientist, I have trouble swallowing that, because I've seen a lot of science do really good things, yeah. And it's corrupted by that, though. It's corrupted by the dollars. And that's where I think it's important to make distinctions, because the science has it had the potential to be very beneficial. And in healthcare, although I've given some really nasty examples, there's some huge benefits that could come out of biotechnology in healthcare. There's no doubt in my mind. And those things have been realized. The harder task is to categorize what's good and what's bad. And, you know, in this era of kind of corporatized everything, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult to be analytical in that way. And you start to put a profit motive on science and it steers the direction of it into something that is, it's not about money and people and you know, the welfare of humanity. It's about something very different.
Another question one has to ask is how closely related corporations such as Monsanto are to the pharmaceutical industry.
I went to Bio in Toronto in 2002, which is the Biotechnology Industry Organization annual meeting, and Bio is one of the biggest meetings in the world. It had almost 15,000 delegates from like over 42 countries or something. And it travels around, and there's a counter conference that travels with it and sets up kind of workshops against biotechnology. And it's this wonderful kind of situation where you just are getting totally smacked on the head by both sides of the debate. And it's so polarized that it's impossible to take away any useful information. Like, it's just like, I found it very bizarre to be kind of hearing rhetoric on both sides. And even kind of the environmental side that I because I'm an environmental scientist, I would totally, you know, have a compassion for. I was just like, wow, like, you know, it's hard to discern, you know, what truth is in that context. But bio is, if you believe that physical reality is a manifestation of kind of inner ideology, you know, the fact that we're in a room like this, the way that it's set up, and you know, usually you have a presenter that stands at the front and he's the expert or she's the expert. You know, classrooms are very kind of domineering in that way. The architecture of this space has an ideology that the architect had. You know, there's all sorts of kind of things that tell us about how people and things operate without actually coming out and saying it. And this particular meeting was one of the scariest things I've ever seen in my life. The amount of money and power and wealth and domination that was physically kind of incarnate in this meeting was, it terrified me. And it was right when I started to do my research. So I was like, okay, let the little Bambi guy, you know, oh, I'm going to do research on biotechnology now. And, you know, I'm doing environmental science, so I might... There might be something critical that comes out of this, and I walk into this meeting and I just about crap myself, you know, going, oh my goodness, if my research butts up against this, I am done. You know, this is scary stuff. And the meeting was terrifying because of the amount of money you could see at it. And the kiosks in the kind of main hall outside of it were all pharmaceutical companies, all kind of ag biotech companies. NASA was there, you know, NASA was working with these companies. There was all kinds of stuff. We didn't spend any time, you know, checking out any of the kiosks, really. We just went and picked up all the free handouts because they were just giving away like, you know, expensive scientific calculators, and they were giving away all this stuff, and we just kind of cruised around like it was Halloween and just picked up all the swag. And one of the things that I got was this laser pointer, and the laser pointer, instead of having a beam on it, has a money sign. And so you point this laser pointer and this money sign came out of it, and it was just like, wow, this is where I am right now, you know. And the links there are, they're one in the same. They're one and the same, and there's links between them, but not really. And so this debate around how to pick and choose, you know, if you agree with me that the science is not necessarily a bad thing, it's the application of the science. If you go there with me, you don't necessarily have to. If you do, it becomes very difficult because the healthcare applications of it, I would say, are probably much greater in benefit than the ag biotech side of it. Yet because they're one and the same, it's hard to differentiate and cleave a line between them. And I recently saw the vice president, a past vice president of Monsanto, give a presentation like last week, and he was saying that we're all in it together, and it was a meeting to kind of industry, and he was like, we're all in it together. If GMO foods don't make it, no one will. So big pharmacy groups, big kind of healthcare biotech groups, you need to protect us. You need to help us, because if we don't make it and GMO foods get labeled as something that shouldn't be around, well, all the biotechnology will. And so they're, the ag biotech groups are holding on to the pharmacy groups going, don't leave us here, don't leave us here. And it's happening within their own industry, right? Like it's there's a fear there because people are waking up, the food safety issues that are happening in the country right now between BSE, you know, the front page of the Globe and Mail 2 weeks ago was clone burgers. I don't know if anybody saw that. The FDA and the Canadian government are talking about allowing cloned meat into the food supply. And you know, Dolly, the infamous kind of first cloned animal, was plagued with all sorts of health issues, And a lot of geneticists will say, well, it's substantially equivalent. It's the exact same DNA. It's just older. There's no problem. There might be some validity to that, but until they really work this out and figure out if there is, you know, problems associated with that, I don't know. I don't want to be eating a cloned burger.
Science and research, just like everything else, costs money. Therefore, how does one take the money and the personal interest that comes with the funding out of the equation without damaging the research? How do we create good science that benefits humanity and not just the corporate world and corrupt governments?
For me as a scientist, that's really the question, because I look at the power of science and how useful it can be. It's a tricky question. Guys like David Suzuki have been asking that question for, you know, he's been asking that question his whole life. You know, how do you make this work? And I've interacted with him a fair amount, and he's basically stepped away from taking any government money. He never took corporate money, but he stepped away from taking even government money because he just found it to be corrupted. And so, you know, where do you go in that kind of world? You know, he started the David Suzuki Foundation, and now, you know, people pay him to do what he does, and it's completely grassroots and a super successful organization. So there's one example. You know, NGOs in general, you know, you've got, you know, from the Council of Canadians to the David Suzuki Foundation, it's pretty empowering stuff to see people deciding, you know, what they want to put their money into and advancing pretty serious kind of either political or scientific education goals. In terms of big science, you know, I don't think it's going to come from the grassroots. So yeah, there's got to be a different strategy. The public sector, you look at the big granting agencies, NSERC, the Natural Science and Engineering Research Council, is the big national organization that investigates, that disperses money for investigators to kind of do science. And unfortunately, they've got very high level of kind of biotech allegiances, and it's hard. The private sector does play a role. They play a role. There's, in today's world, they play a role. They play an important role in a lot of ways. It's a matter of putting controls on them. You know, I don't think that private companies should be completely abolished. It's a matter of having the public sector be in the driver's seat. There's a way to do that, I'm certain. You know, the patent laws, you know, there's a way to create a context for private business to do research that doesn't completely pervert and screw over society. There's a way to do that for sure. Percy Schmeiser at the Supreme Court was a way that they could have dealt with that. They should have sided with him. And it was a 5-4 split. Public policy can't be decided at the Supreme Court on a 5-4 split where the Supreme Court was completely divided on what to do. And that, you know, the Supreme Court should have a mechanism that if it's a 5-4 split, it should immediately be taken up in Parliament the next day until they sort it out. Because there's no way that, you know, companies should be able to patent the genes in our body, privatize them, make money off it, and not put any money back into the public purse. you know, at a minimum, there should be some sort of cost split. You know, oh, you're making money off society's genes? Well, we should get a kickback. You know, at a minimum, there should be something. I think there's lots of ways to structure it. You know, the, you know, should companies be able to take patents out on genes? I don't think so. I don't think they should at all. You know, there's got to be other ways for them to have incentive. And, you know, you look at the history of the patent system, it was to create incentive. And you basically, the history of the patent system and the reason why patents exist is you get a patent because you disclose to the public how it works, as opposed to a trade secret. Like Coca-Cola's, you know, formula for Coke is a trade secret. Nobody knows what actually goes into the, you know, the magic syrup in Coke, because it's a private entity. It's something that the public doesn't have. The society gives patents in exchange for the information. So we know all the information about these genetically engineered crops. The patents office gets all the information, and then the company gets, you know, a certain amount of time that they get to exploit the patent before it becomes a public item, and that's the trade-off. The public system has given added time to the time in which private companies get to exploit their patents. So it was like 10 years and now it's 20, you know, and the copyright bylaws are being rewritten right now. The Copyright Act in Canada is being rewritten, and they're giving, you know, copyright is the same sort of thing that people who write a book, it's like life plus 50 years or something like that, you know, is the standard thing before it becomes in fair use in the public, for the public good. And so, you know, you can cite, or you can use like a photo from you know, the 1400s without asking permission from the original painter or photographer, because it's not, they don't own the copyright anymore. But now you can't do that. You know, if the person's still alive, you have to go and get permission from them. They might want money for it or whatever. And now they're extending the period in which, you know, these copyrights over everything last, to the point where, you know, you can't even get access to it anymore, because it's like life plus the, you know, life of your grandkids plus the life of your grandkids. And so the public system is being eroded and chipped away at everywhere we go, and we're the ones that make the rules. We don't have to allow that to happen. I personally don't think we should stand up for anything less than what we want, you know. And if we want a system that has accountability for those companies, we can create it. And that's, you know, you look at Paul Hawken and you look at some of these guys that have looked at like the history of corporations and stuff like that. There was lots of controls put on them, and I can't remember, I've read all this stuff, but I can't remember any of it. But there was a time where these companies were very regulated and they had certain parameters for which they could work in, and we've since given those up. And, you know, it's perhaps time to reclaim that. And I think it's happening.
You have been listening to the second part of a discussion on genetically modified organisms, which was led by Ian Moreau, a researcher at the University of Manitoba, who is doing his PhD on environmental and socioeconomic risks and benefits of genetically modified crops. Moreau has been studying genetically modified organisms for the past 4 years and has had the opportunity to talk to many world experts about this subject. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and this documentary was produced for CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM Winnipeg.